The Right Question is funded by the Steele Reese Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
Who is Dave?
Dave is a female dog with three legs. Dave is based on a real dog. I have a friend that I met in the Navy who I'm still close friends with, and he and his wife had a dog named Dave who was a girl dog. And she got hit by a car when she was a puppy, and she didn't actually lose her leg, but she had a pretty bad limp, so I decided to use that. Exaggerate that a little bit and use her as a character in the book as sort of a parallel to Pete.
Welcome to The Right Question, a literary program that features writers from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Russell Rowland about his latest novel, High and Inside. Pete Hurley, in your novel, used to play baseball for the Red Sox, and he's very famous. So explain why he's quit the game.
Well, Pete had an unfortunate incident at the end of his career where a pitch got away from him and it hit a Yankee player in the eye socket and put him out of the game for good. That guy was never able to play again. And it sparked sort of a controversy in the whole sports media crowd, where there was some speculation about whether Pete had hit him on purpose because someone else had hit somebody earlier in the game from the other team. So all the media publicity that came from that incident sort of piled onto what was already sort of a shaky psychological profile, and Pete was never able to pitch again. He sort of lost it mentally.
So he's moved himself and Dave to Bozeman, and they're going to start a new life. But he has a drinking problem, mm-hmm. which immediately starts messing things up. It messed things up when he was back east, and now it's messing things up again. What made you want to write about an alcoholic, to create an alcoholic character?
Well, I struggled with alcohol myself when I was younger, and have been sober for quite a while now. So I actually wanted to write a book from that perspective, because it seems like so many people are baffled by alcoholic behavior for good reason. And I just sort of wanted to see if I could explore what it's like from the other side in a way that might explain a little bit about what makes alcoholics act the way they do. I think one of the things that you hear most frequently from people is, when he's got so much going for him, he could lose everything. Why does he keep going back to it? And so I wanted to see if I could sort of get into the head of someone who's in that position and show a little bit of what that's like to the public, to the reader.
I think you did.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Sometimes it's hard to figure out why people are trying to self-destruct all the time.
Yeah.
And that was very apparent in this story.
One of the things that is sort of, you can't really generalize all alcoholics are this way or that way. But one thing that is pretty consistent is that, they just have such an exaggerated view of their role in life is. And so they're either completely focused on blaming other people for their problems, or they're completely focused on taking the blame for all their problems. And a lot of them will fluctuate back and forth between those two things. And it sort of brings on this feeling of utter hopelessness, that you can't ever fix all the things that are wrong in your life. And so they turn to alcohol, over and over again. And then it just keeps perpetuating the problem, of course. I guess the one thing that I wanted to accomplished with this book was to show how essentially when someone has a drinking problem, you know, it's always pretty unpredictable what's going to bring them out of it. And in Pete's case, like with a lot of people, it ends up being a connection with somebody else who also has a problem. But also, you know, I wanted to sort of show how people that are in that situation tend to keep the things that are probably going to help them the most to themselves. So they end up isolating themselves to keep from talking about the things that they need to talk about more than anything. And eventually it's talking about those things that's going to bring them out of it. And I wanted to explore that.
I know everybody's different. Every alcoholic is different, and every person interacting with an alcoholic is different. But is there any general observation you can offer?
I guess basically the thing that most people don't understand is that there's nothing that they can do to change somebody that's like that, that it has to come from within. And there's a phrase that's pretty common in recovery. It's if somebody wants help, there's nothing that you can say that's wrong. And if they don't want help, there's nothing that you can say that's right.
Let's go back to what happened to Pete when he stopped playing baseball. If you could just read the first few paragraphs of chapter 2, that's where you tell that story.
Okay. First is a quote from Pardon the Interruption from Tony Kornheiser. Pete Hurley has become the Robert Downey Jr. of Major League Baseball. You want him in your movie, but you don't want him at the cast party. My best game for the Boston Red Sox came during the 2005 season in Fenway Park. The scheduled starter came down with a sore elbow during warm-ups, and Terry Francona pulled me aside 20 minutes before the national anthem. For 7 years before that, I'd been a steady presence in the bullpen with occasional spot starts. Even in those starts, I was merely consistent. I had an average fastball, a good curve, but the pitch I was known for was my changeup. But that night I fell into a rhythm. The best part, we were playing the Yankees. Bernie Williams got a leadoff double in the fourth, but his teammates left him stranded on second. In the seventh, with two outs, Posada hit a long liner that probably would have been a home run in any other park, but the Green Monster knocked it down, holding him to a single. Those were the only two hits I gave up in that game. Johnny Damon, still a Red Sox, tracked down a fly to dead center at the warning track, and Kevin Millar dove to spear a drive down the first baseline that would have been a sure double. The only blip in the early innings was when I hit Jeter in the third. There were a few shouts from the Yankee dugout. A couple innings later, Andy Pettitte hit Veritek right in the back, and the umpire issued a warning to both teams. Veritek called a masterful game, and it seemed that wherever he positioned his mitt, whether it was on the outside black or down at the knees, the ball popped within an inch or two of the target. My curve spun like a gyroscope, and my changeup had the batter swinging way before the ball arrived. When I strolled out to the mound for the ninth inning, the crowd gave me a standing ovation. I'd never experienced anything like it. For that moment, I felt completely adored, maybe for the only time in my life. Unfortunately, the second batter of that inning was the one I became famous for. On a 2-2 count, I decided to give my fastball a little extra, and the pitch got away from me. The ball sailed high and inside, and the crack of bat against bone lifted my balls right up into my throat. The crowd, still standing, moaned as the player crumpled. I hit him square in the eye socket. He never played again, and neither did I.
Pitchers hitting players is something that's a continual controversy in baseball, right?
Yes. Occasionally there's talk about, you know, they need to make the penalties more severe for if somebody hits somebody intentionally, so that there's not this constant back and forth of, you know, one team hitting a player and then the other team doing it to get back at the first team.
So this is something that Pete has to live with for the rest of his life, which is one of a series of things that he's kind of running away from with his life back east. He also had a girlfriend who ended up paralyzed. He was part of a family.
Right.
So describe who this family was and Charlie and Simone.
Right. Well, Pete, when he was 16, his father died and he had already lost his mother at a young age. So he was left without a family at all. His sister had already left Massachusetts when she married a guy from Bozeman. So Pete went to his neighbor, Charlie, who was his best friend, and just told him what happened. And Charlie's parents basically told him that they were going to take him in. They said, you can just live with us. And Simone was Charlie's younger sister, quite a bit younger, 10 years younger than Pete and Charlie. So he didn't really know Simone as a child or when she was younger. But when he gets to the point where he's out of baseball, Simone has grown into this attractive young woman and they end up having an affair.
And he doesn't remember
right.
what happened to her.
Yeah. The night that she's injured, he was in a blackout. So he knows what happened, but he doesn't remember it at all. So he's got that on his conscience, too.
And blacking out seems to be a fairly common occurrence.
Yes, Pete likes to drink to oblivion.
He also loses Dave in a blackout.
Right, yes. Although he doesn't know that for quite some time either. He thinks she's just disappeared.
And the surprise when Dave returns, we will not reveal.
Right.
Before Pete and Simone have an affair, when she's considerably younger, she gets on a motorcycle with Pete.
Mm.
And that's a short bit that I'd like you to read.
Okay. It was just after junior college when I got my first minor league contract that I went through my Harley phase. One luxury of not worrying about money was the freedom to pursue unconventional hobbies without giving a damn about the consequences. When Charlie saw my bike, he shook his head, but he was smiling. He circled the machine, dressed in his khakis and boat shoes, hands on his hips. Simone came running outside, her skinny legs flying out to the sides. She was 10 and still quite a tomboy. "I want a ride," she screeched. "Come on, Pete, just a short one. Please, 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 please." I climbed onto the bike and Charlie lifted Simone up behind me where she perched. "Come on, let's go." She bounced on the seat. "All right." I cranked the starter, coming down hard with my foot, and the unmistakable Harley rattle started. I gunned it, and the air whipped our clothes into a frantic flapping of cotton. I hadn't thought to buy goggles, so I had to squint. The asphalt blurred, and the houses rushed by in a colorful smear. I turned my head just enough to ask Simone how she was doing, and in that instant, I learned the lesson that most bikers do, that you absolutely cannot take your eyes off the road. A car pulled out from a side street, and I barely caught it in the corner of my eye. 20 yards away, a face turned and the eyes grew. The mouth opened in a silent scream and brakes squealed. Hands spread into fans to cover the face. I never even knew whether it was a man or a woman. Simone shrieked into my ear. I veered. My right knee clipped the headlight just enough to tear a chunk of skin. It didn't even rip my jeans. Although we missed the car, I was pissed, so I kept going, not trusting what I'd do if I stopped. I took the next right, slowing, and tried to breathe. I was about to cry, not from pain, but from complete terror. Simone was silent, but I felt her fingernails digging into my stomach. My knee ached. I circled slowly until I was fairly calm. Then I stopped. "You all right?" My voice shook. I tried to climb off the bike, but Simone would not let go. Her arms trembled. I twisted on the saddle so I could put my arms around her, and we held each other, shivering, while Simone cried. "I'm okay," she whispered. "You sure?" "Yeah, I'm fine." "We can't say anything, you know." "I know." But it didn't matter. When we got back to the house, despite our best efforts, our pasty color and saucer eyes gave us away. I climbed off the bike and lifted Simone to the ground. Charlie and his dad strode and then rushed across the lawn. Simone wobbled when I set her down. Her face was as pale as bread dough. Charlie stopped when he saw her. So did her father. Neither spoke. "Well, that was fun," I said, and I felt the blood trickle down my shin.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman. Russell Rowland is here, and we're talking about his latest novel, High and Inside. After a short break, he'll read the passage from the book in which Pete meets his love interest. Stay tuned. One of the components of Pete's new life is building a house. He's bought some land. We should say that even before Pete became a famous baseball player, he didn't have to worry about money.
Right. Yeah, his father was basically a developer, so he had amassed a pretty good fortune by the time he died, and Pete and his sister both inherited that.
And he's determined to build his own house. Even though his experience, you write, with machinery has been limited to putting gas in his car, he wants to build a house. So he's bought a book and he's reading the book. Why does he want to tackle such a huge project by himself?
Well, I think it's sort of a typical a way of approaching something like this for someone in his position. You know, oh, this, you know, I'll go to this place where nobody knows me and take on something completely new. You know, the whole idea of Montana being a place where you can reinvent yourself was one thing that I wanted to explore too. But sort of an easy way out, you know, I'm going to do this thing that I can do by myself in solitary. So the less people involved, the less problems I'm going to have. Very typical alcoholic thinking that, you know, my problem is other people. So if I do this one thing that I don't have to rely on other people, then I can get my life together, get some peace, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and then one of the first people he meets is Clint Weaver.
Yes.
Who causes him some big problems.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I needed an antagonist, and Clint turned out to be a pretty good fit for that. He's a city inspector who has a lot of pull, and he and Pete end up getting into a fight right off the bat one of his first nights in town. So he gets off on the wrong foot pretty much right away.
So when he starts building his house, he gets some visits that
right
from some people telling him he has to make changes to his foundation. And
right. Yeah. City inspectors getting in the way.
Pete has, as a lot of people do who come to Montana, a dream of living a life of solitude. As you mentioned before, people who are trying to blame other people for their problems think that if they live without other people, then their problems will go away.
Mm-hmm.
But Pete finds out the first night that he is out there living on his land. He hasn't built his house yet, but he has a trailer that he's living in. He finds out that solitude is not all it's cracked up to be.
Right.
Describe his response.
Yeah, well, a lot of people today probably, you know, he doesn't realize how accustomed he is to having something going on around him all the time with, you know, TV and the internet and whatever. So the isolation is way more intense than he anticipated it would be. So, yeah, he pretty much can't handle being alone in the quiet like that and ends up going to the familiar. He goes back into town to the bar again.
just basically gets in his truck and drives for town after he's been out there just a few hours.
Yeah, makes a beeline for the bar.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, there's a love interest in the novel,
right.
A woman named Leslie. And I would like you just to read the chapter where they meet. At the beginning of each chapter, you have a quote, either from a sportscaster or from a book. And this quote in the beginning of chapter 3 is from Your House, Yourself, which I assume is a fictitious book.
Right. I made that book up just as a sort of a resource that Pete has that is supposedly going to help him get this house built.
Yeah, it's very clever. I looked it up online and didn't find it, so I knew you made it up. But this it's a very clever book.
Right. People often make the mistake of looking for a piece of land they can afford without much thought about how that location will impact their lives. For instance, a lot of people dream of a house in the country or a cabin in the mountains, but living miles from nowhere or tucked away in the trees is challenging in ways that many people don't anticipate. Choosing where your house will be located requires knowing yourself. It requires a lot of thought and reflection. Chapter 1, Location, 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 Your House, Yourself.
And that's a quote from the book.
Right. Chapter 3, My Land. What a wonderful phrase. These words feel good in my mouth, like soft, warm, homemade caramel. My land. My land is lush. It's green, thick with grass, brush, and a stand of sturdy pine. It smells of fresh, moist soil. The Bridger Mountains are not close, but they are extremely present. Their rocky peaks angular across the horizon. When I stand in the middle of my land, I'm amazed at how much I feel the mountains. Without them, my land would feel more vulnerable and less beautiful. The mountains provide a visual image of something, what to expect, maybe. Hopes, dreams. In open spaces, there's too much unknown. Dave, I call out, realizing that she's wandered off. Looking to the stand of pine trees, I assume that she has followed her instincts to explore. I enter the woods and the temperature drops 10 degrees. The rich pine smell fills my nose. I call out again, but hear nothing, see nothing. 50 feet into the trees, I encounter a barbed wire fence. There are several no trespassing signs posted. So I traverse the length of the fence, calling Dave's name, scanning what little is visible. I'm not panicked. Dave is a dog, after all. She's resourceful, an adventurer. Even if she hears me, she may not be interested in being found just yet. I'm mostly thinking about this revelation that Simone wants to see me. The last time I saw anyone from her family other than Charlie, it ended badly. It was just days after the accident, days after I had left their daughter paralyzed. And the message I got that day was clear. So why would things suddenly change? After seeing no sign of Dave, I cross the fence and push deeper into the trees. The floor of the woods is soft, dark, moist soil, mostly free of living plants, but covered with a thick blanket of pine needles. The smells are rich, earthy, and wonderful. I can feel the air as cool and soothing as a liquid. Squirrels scamper from view, and a deer elegantly pokes her hooves into the wheat grass in the distance. I become so absorbed in the atmosphere that I forget my purpose. After roaming for 15 minutes, I crouch to study a rotting tree stump that is crawling with life. Then I stand, take 2 steps forward, and come face to face with a rifle barrel. Damn. This quiet exclamation takes all the breath I have. The face at the opposite end glares at me, steady and serious. The eyes do not appear wild or angry, just steady, challenging. Who are you? A woman's voice. As the picture comes more into focus, I realize that a big felt cowboy hat and hair pulled into a ponytail have disguised her sex. I take a deep breath. Have you seen a dog? A pause. A three-legged dog? Her brow furrows, and she frowns. You serious? My dog wandered off. She's only got 3 legs. Is that why she wandered off? I smile, although it doesn't seem like a very good idea. She does not smile. Could be, but I don't think so. That was just offered as information, a way of identifying. Who are you? I hold out my hand, offering to shake, reaching as far as the gun will allow. Pete, I just bought the next lot over. Pete what? I'm annoyed with this oily appendage in my face. It seems extreme, maybe even illegal. Do you mind? I tilt my head toward the gun. I've never had a gun pointed at me. I don't like it much. Although her eyes soften a bit, her brow lowers until it nearly hides her eyes. She appears to be young, fresh-faced, with apple cheeks and a full mouth, like a teenage boy without the peach fuzz. Maybe there's a good reason for it, she says. Yeah, I suppose there could be, but I'm your new neighbor, not just some random homeless person. I'm sorry I climbed over the fence, but I wanted to find my dog. Where are you from? You have an accent. Slowly, she tilts the gun and allows the barrel to slide through her hand. The stock comes to rest on the ground next to her foot, but she looks nervous, tense, ready to pull it back into position at the slightest hint of danger. And it's at this point that I recognize the expression in her eyes is not threatening, angry, or crazy, but simply afraid. Back east, I answer, Massachusetts. Why'd you move to Montana? To build a house. Now the scene is odd. It's like party conversation, but with a twist. So you come here often? I ask in my best lounge lizard cool. This prompts a very slight grin. What's your name? I ask. Annie, she answers with a glint. Annie Oakley. Ah, congratulations on the resurrection thing. She doesn't laugh, but the smile becomes a little wider, very little. Her face reddens, seconds pass, and it's apparent she has nothing left to say. So you haven't seen my dog? She shakes her head. Three legs, huh? I turn, heading toward my property, first backwards, then a little to one side, always with an eye on Miss Oakley to assure her I'm not going to make any sudden moves. I'm in a cowboy movie, striding with the senseless confidence that my bravado will trump any danger. I'm John Wayne. Let me know if you see her, I say. What's her name? Dave. Another slight smile, but she won't give me any more than that. Okay, Dave, the three-legged girl dog. Got it. I'd invite you over for lunch sometime, Annie, but I think it would be hard to eat and hold a gun at the same time. I've nearly lost sight of her. My name's Leslie, she calls out. Leslie Monday. Ah, so you use an alias. I wave. Good strategy. I weave my way through the trees, calling Dave's name as I go, and after climbing back into my land and nearly emerging from the forest, I hear the uneven rhythm of three legs padding over the soft bed. I'm happy to see the brindle coat winding between the pines. Where you been, girl? I crouch, and Dave's tongue bathes my cheeks. Did you get a good look around? Dave smiles, breathing hard, and leads me out of the trees as if she can't wait to show me something. We break from the trees into the open where my land spreads out before us. What do you think, Dave? She looks at me, barks once, and trots forward, her torso rocking like a hobby horse. I would say that she's never been so happy, except that I don't remember her ever being anything other than happy. Are we home?
Russell Rowland lives in Billings, Montana. There's more information about him at mtpr.org. Also there, book reviews, poems, and links to our podcast and Facebook page.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau, Lisa Simon, David Moore, and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.